You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
A little bit late, but my very good friend and one of your faves, Richard Pithouse, understands the importance of that last conversation we had. We had to let it breathe a little bit, particularly because actually we don't focus that much on sexuality, funny enough, despite the fact that some of you think I do. But it is time for the Literature Corner. Have we played this thing? Really? Play it again, man. Just for control.
702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
Thank you for indulging me. I want us to talk about how to read what I call generously but critically. Reading is a skill. And yeah, I'm not subtweeting the 10-year-olds in the country. I'm subtweeting us as adults. And I remember going through a phase as an undergraduate in my honors year, going to my mentor, who was eventually my supervisor at my master, for my master's degree, Marius. And I said to him, Marius, I think I'm out of form now, like a bad cricket player. I can no longer spot easy objections when I'm reading The Republic by Plato. I can't obviously see what's wrong anymore. I used to be so good at spotting the fallacies in undergrad. And he said to me, Eusebius, you are now growing up. You're learning to actually read to try and understand why is this book such a big thing for such a long period of time. You don't always have to find fault in the first sentence. So it is a skill, and sometimes we lash out very quickly. You read a column, you read an essay, you read a book, and all you want to do is a hatchet job. And for me, there are a couple of people who are good examples of people who just read very closely. And there are many in the country, but not enough. Two of them, like I've said before, are Bongani Madondo, who is generous to a fault. And the other person is Richard Pithouse, and he's with us here in the studio. Richard, thank you so much for joining me.
It's always a pleasure, Eusebius.
There's so much here for you and I to unpack, Richard. You said something that I've stolen as my own words, but I think I've credited you enough for it now, which is that sometimes people don't appreciate the importance, firstly, of reading slowly.
Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, I mean, these days we're all confronted by an avalanche of text. It's just constantly moving through our phones, and we do tend to go very, very fast. But there's certain kinds of things that are not well served by being read in that way. And there are certain texts that have been around sometimes, like the one you mentioned in the opening, for thousands of years, and that do require very slow and careful reading if we really want to make adequate sense of them.
Why, I don't know, do you think it's because of social media, or do you think it's the way in which we are taught, particularly at universities, that we have to quickly find fault with a text or with an essay or with a thinker? You know, like, I mean, I don't know how you approach your exams, but particularly a discipline that both of us share, philosophy. I used to always like make a mental note as a youngster going into an exam thinking, okay, what are my three objections against utilitarianism? And you're like, cool, I've got my first in the bag as long as I can write, crunch out this essay in the exam because I've got my stock objections, my three objections against Immanuel Kant. So it kind of like inculcates in you this like culture of looking for mistakes as opposed to trying to make sense.
I think that's very true. And I think that's particularly true of a kind of culture that's developed in philosophy maybe since the 1930s, where intelligence is often assumed to be precisely that, finding the flaw quickly and clearly. But often that does lead us into a situation where we miss the actual weight of the text and what's really going on. I mean, I know for myself, you know, the way I was taught to read poems in high school was it's almost like it's a mathematical problem to be solved.
Yes,
what's going
right
on here? You know, is the alliteration? What is the symbolism?
Yeah.
I think it took me a good 10 years after school to actually be able to approach a poem not as a problem to be solved, but as a kind of profound, when it's done well anyway, communication and to be open to it, to experience it spontaneously and emotionally. So, you know, I mean, no disrespect to generations of English teachers, but I mean, really, teaching poetry in that way had the complete reverse effect of probably what was intended.
Yeah.
And we should think about those things. And universities, there's a rush for an essay, for an exam. You want to perform. I mean, yeah, sometimes you don't want to savor the text and you don't want to be... And you want to use what you already know to quickly put that text in a box.
Yes.
And to label it, as opposed to allowing A kind of open, spontaneous encounter with that text, which may change you.
That's absolutely true. What changed it for you? Do you think it's just a personality trait? Is it just part of one's academic and intellectual journey? And I don't want to restrict it to university education, because I also think there are people who are not PhDs and professors or even have graduate studies under their belt who do have a remarkable ability, and some of our arts journalists in this country actually are quite good at that, at being able to write with generosity. If anything, I think you might be less inclined to do so if you're probably inside the academy. But in your own journey, how did you get to a point where you engage text in a way where you don't let your critical faculties down? Because if you write a big essay, as you often do for the Mail and Guardian, and you go after us liberals and the limits of liberalism, it's not like you're going to be soft on us. But you try and grapple with, why is it that Eusebius, who regards himself as serious about fighting injustice, why is Eusebius a liberal? Why is this black lefty self-identifying as a liberal? How did you get to a point where you are both critical, but at the same time you are very generous as a reader?
I guess it depends where the imperative for critique comes from. If it comes from a kind of dogmatism, and you get all different kinds of dogmatism. I mean, you know, you can have a Christian fundamentalist who's every bit as dogmatic as a Marxist fundamentalist, you know, then I suppose one is always engaging the world and reading as part of that with the desire, perhaps unconscious, to confirm your dogmatism.
Sure.
Because you have a kind of authoritarian, paranoid relation to the world.
Mm.
And things that don't fit with that need to be ignored. Or delegitimated very, very rapidly, because if they're not, you have to stop and ask deeper questions.
Mm.
So I suppose it depends how you understand the world. If you think that there is a theory or a excuse me, or a worldview that has all the answers, then you know you can read voraciously, but just looking for things to confirm that.
Mm.
But if you think that theory is never complete, that there's no political project, there's no intellectual project that has all the answers, that deals with everything and that deals with everything adequately, then one must be open to the new, and one must understand that your understanding of the world is always dynamic, it's always in progress. And I suppose that's a very different way of being in the world.
I think that is such an important and beautiful insight, because if I understand you correctly, I will never learn to read generously and critically and potentially see new layers in a text, in any book, unless I am comfortable with the possibility that my current worldview may have to be re-examined after doing so. And if you are scared or haven't been taught or told that it is permissible to examine your cherished views about the world, then you're going to be less inclined to read a text with a certain kind of open-mindedness and possibility of changing your worldview. I mean, there's an Oxbridge philosopher who's written a book, How to Be a Conservative, which a very cheeky friend of mine gave to me as a birthday gift last year, because he knows that as a liberal, it will rile me up. And I stare at that book on my shelf all the time, and I want to take it because I love Scruton's work. But at the same time, the question is, will I approach it with the same kind of excitement as I do the work of Ta-Nehisi Coates? And it seems to me that's part of the problem, right, is that I shouldn't fear the possibility that if I read this book called How to Be a Conservative, then I can read that book with generosity. But it requires an orientation that suggests potentially I may have to be susceptible to re-examining deeply held beliefs about myself.
Yes, I mean, I guess ultimately it depends on what we understand human being to be. You know, I mean, is it something that is fundamentally open? Is there an element of the mysterious about it? Or is it fixed, you know?
Mm.
And a lot of people are very anxious about openness, about motion, about, you know, Walt Whitman's famous line, you know, about containing, you know, containing contradictions, about being large. It's easier for us to make sense of the world and our place in it if everything is fixed and not in motion and not open.
Absolutely.
But we are definitely going to miss things. I mean, it is totally possible to learn things from someone who you fundamentally disagree with. There may be empirical things.
Absolutely.
But there may even be ethical things.
Yeah, 100%. You
know? 702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
Let's take this tweet from one of my favorite humans, Chris Kabatwa, at the university currently known as Rhodes. You see, Chris, this is exactly the point. I think you and I have a mutual appreciation society going on. But ironically enough, your tweet is exhibit A of what we're talking about here with respect to you, my good friend. Chris tweets the following, Richard. Mm-hmm. A Marxist, really, Eusebius, a Marxist reading of literature is quote-unquote authoritarian dogmatism. That's pure stereotyping of those who bring the complexity of both the structural and personal agency. Now, here's how I'd want to challenge you, Chris, and the conversation we're having doesn't just apply to texts, by the way. It also extends, and this is how it intersects with the conversation with Jacques Rousseau yesterday, to how we hear each other. I mean, why are you hearing the worst possible version of what Richard is saying? If I understood Richard correctly, and if we take a posture that says, assuming Richard is not a stupid person, what might he be saying here? Right. If that's the starting point of your listening to someone, and the same goes for how we read a text, I don't think you would have come up with that tweet. Because if you try to grapple with the question, what is Richard trying to say here? Richard is a careful thinker, so presumably he's not saying something silly. Then I think you would have heard him differently. And the way I heard him, Chris, is that anyone who has a commitment to a certain ideological position could be susceptible to looking to confirm it when they read a text. Richard, you can speak for yourself, but that's how I understood you.
Sure. I mean, I just use those as two examples because they're ordinarily understood as being diametrically opposed. I mean, of course, I wasn't saying that Marxism is inherently authoritarian. On the contrary, I mean the most innovative theory and practice in Marxism is profoundly democratic. But it's undeniable that there are individuals and states that have turned those ideas into an alibi for all kinds of authoritarianism. But I mean, that's true of any ideology. That's the point I was trying to make.
Yeah.
I was just using it as an example.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple of texts which will make the conversation even come more alive. Mm-hmm. I said to you when we spoke yesterday in preparation for this show, for me, an example of the kinds of writing and text and authors who typically have people just taking swipes at their work without actually trying to be generous in the reading. Someone like James Coetzee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm a big fan of James Coetzee, so someone might say I'm just being an apologist. But I don't have much respect for someone's reading ability if they think they've got nothing to learn from reading James Coetzee. I mean, it just can't be the case. The man is one of the most important writers in the English world. He has an incredible oeuvre, an incredible career behind him. And even a text that divides readers and critics and scholars, like, say, Disgrace.
Mm-hmm.
You may be irritated by their text. I've had white friends of mine saying, I don't like the text because when this professor is running after laborers in a field to remonstrate with them about the rape of his daughter, mm-hmm. that is pathetic. Actually, he should have rage. And then I've had many of my black friends who've said, the black characters in Disgrace are flat. They don't have humanity. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't like Disgrace. And both of those interpretations of what makes that a weak text, I'm fine with. But there's also something to be said for the incredible control of language that James Coetzee has. He writes with an economy that makes you jealous. You read every sentence. It's not ostentatious. It goes very quickly. And the writer and reader in me go, how is this man able to create literary magic without being over the top and ostentatious? And I just struggle with people who can be dismissive of a text like Disgrace, Richard, without even trying to understand why is it that this particular text has had longevity?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something in the kind of in the moment that we inhabit in which knee-jerk and often very moralizing dismissals are are common, and there's a often they're performative. They're not done privately. I mean, they're often done for a kind of audience. I mean, of course, there are all kinds of critiques of Coetzee's work, the ones you've mentioned, there are others. I mean, for some people, it's just too bleak and too grey. They where's the life? They're like, give me, you know, Isabel Allende's Eva Luna. Give me some colour and love and desire and taste. And you know, there's also something deeply personal about literature as well. Mm. I mean, what works for one person will not work for another person. And it's also about where you are in your life and at the moment. But it's undeniable that Coetzee has extraordinary skills as a writer. I mean, many years ago, more than 20 years ago, when I taught philosophy at what was then the University of Durban-Westville, I had some students who came in to university who'd been taught to write in an extremely formalistic way without paying real attention to the precise content of what they were saying. That's what they'd learned at school. And I found giving them a novel like Coetzee's Waiting for the Barbarians, say, and asking them to read that often rapidly transformed their capacity to write, because suddenly they became aware of how you can write in such a way that every sentence, every word is there for a very specific reason. And you can write with that absolute clarity and precision. And suddenly you find someone who was speaking in very empty generalizations, cliches, suddenly making a real argument about a philosophical question. Yeah. So, you know, a kind of dismissal of Coetzee's entire body of work based on kind of reaction to one novel probably would be limiting.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing about us as readers and also about reviewers. I was saying this to two friends of mine yesterday who are authors. We were having this discussion about the review of a book that we'd read and we're busy debating. What I bring to my reading will influence my interaction with the text.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when we lash out at a text or an author, rather than grappling with what is it that this person was trying to do with this project, it's amazing how we also can often be lacking in self-reflexiveness and understanding that no two people's experiences of a text, as with a film, as with a piece of theater, can be the same, because my beliefs, my educational background, my lived experiences, all of those things will determine how I interact with this text.
And we interact with it at different points at different times in our
lives. And different points in our lives. I mean, I, for example, have now, and I've said this before, I've been scared to actually go back to Disgrace, which I used to enjoy rereading, mm-hmm. because I'm scared that I will hate it now.
Look, I knew
which is entirely possible. You know, and that's just one example.
Sure, and of course, Great Disgrace is set in Grahamstown.
So exactly, it's all exactly.
Kind of really intense response to the book. You know, that happens. I mean, I read Pablo Neruda voraciously as a young man. I can't really remember when I started, but certainly in my 20s through to my early 30s, until I read his memoirs. And he describes in his memoirs when he was the consul general for Chile in what's now Sri Lanka and Ceylon then, he describes himself raping a woman who used to come and clear the shit out of his house every day. You can't read Pablo Neruda again in the same way after you've read that, you know, especially when it comes to the eroticism in his work. But there's other, but you see, things happen that completely change the way you relate to a writer and to the text.
Mm.
And it's not always simple. It can be very complex. But you know, you can even ask profound questions about what it was that you were seeing in the text before.
Sure. Let's take two final examples. I haven't read Kiss of the Spider Woman. Is that a text? Is that a novel that divides people in terms of how they see it?
It's not so much that. I mean, when your producer asked me a question about kind of being open to a text. I thought of that, and it was kind of, I mean, it's a strange coincidence, because it was before I knew what you were discussing in the hour and a half before this discussion, because I read that, it's a novel by a writer from Argentina, Manuel Puig, and I mean, I must have been probably 14, maybe 13 when I read it. I was interested in prison writing at the time, growing up in a, you know, totalitarian society. And I found that it in SPCA Fate, and it's about a Marxist revolutionary who's imprisoned for involvement. Look, I haven't read this thing for more than 30 years, but for his involvement in a strike, and he's put in a prison cell with one other person who's a transgender person who's there because of his, her gender and sexuality. And it's about the relationship between these two people and the intimacies that develop, including, in the end, physical intimacy. It certainly wasn't what I was expecting when I read that book. But when I read that book, I was very interested in political repression. I was very interested in questions around race. I was very interested in questions around the position of women in society and in the family. I had never thought politically about transgender people. And that book was, it surprised me. And it was a real challenge to me. And I think that is the first time I ever thought about that question. But it wasn't what I was looking for. I was looking for something completely different. You know, it was the Marxist revolutionary in jail that I was looking for. But the author had a much deeper and more profound set of questions about society and justice than the ones I had entered with, which were valid, but this was much broader.
Absolutely.
And for a 13 or 14 year old, as I was then, it really was something new and something that in a way shook part of my sense of who I was and changed me, you know.
A final question, Richard, and this will probably require a longer discussion along a workshopping line on a future occasion. I mean, I've seen some of the students and met and interacted with some of the students that you've taught when you were at Rhodes. And obviously many of them were just bright. You learn a lot from them, as any good teacher will acknowledge. But at the same time, a lot of them have a maturity beyond their years in terms of how they read texts, how they engage with everything from jazz musicians' place in the world. And it's remarkable, something that you often don't find even amongst brilliant academics. Is it possible for us to teach at a general level, let's say, for example, in the South African public space, people how to read more closely, generously, but critically? Because when you look at debate and discussion on Twitter, on Facebook, on the letters pages, it's amazing how unkind and often how very reductionist people are about one another's work.
That's very true, and I don't think you can always teach it, but I think you can in many instances. I mean, if you insist that people read, you know, they have to read, if they're at postgrad level especially, if they have to read a book a week, if you make sure that they write about it in a way and discuss it in a way that really shows that they've engaged it, if you give them a variety of texts to read with different positions, but credible, sometimes compelling texts that take different views, and if you insist, as a rule, in terms of writing and in terms of discussion in a seminar situation, that you don't say anything that you can't support, and you don't shut anyone else down if they take, on the basis of a considered engagement with a text, a different view, I think there can be educational, pedagogic encounters that are transformative. I mean, of course, one learns a tremendous amount from one's students, but part of the privilege of teaching is just watching people grow, and sometimes incredibly rapidly. And, you know, often a student will come in, and 3 months down the line, the way they're writing, the way they're thinking, how they understand the world, their openness to complexity, to nuance, can undergo a kind of extraordinarily rapid advancement. So I think the answer to your question is yes. I mean, how one does that in a broader public sphere, of course, is a different question to how one does it in a seminar situation, but it is possible.
I think the one practical advice you gave is a good starting point, which is asking people to provide textual evidence. If someone says, for example, no, Sisonka Mzimang's book was just crap, well, what do you mean by that? And can you cite me textual examples for specific chapters? If you say this character didn't work for me in Life and Times of Michael Kay, explain that. So just beginning a dialectical conversation beyond the person's assertion of how they felt about the text, I think is a good way to start. Richard, thank you so much for coming on.
Sure thing.